Welcome to MotoPod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 587, the MotoGP season review. I'm your host, Jim McDowell, and with me to discuss this season in review is a very special guest. My best mate, the guy that I go to the races with, he is Joel Seifert. Say hello, Joel.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me today, Jim.
So what I thought, since Joel's with me and we're actually sharing the same area, not doing this over Skype or anything, was him and I are big hockey fans, so we usually wind up going to Columbus to watch the Blue Jackets play. So we usually spend an hour in a car talking about MotoGP all the time. And Andy came up with the idea like, hey, why don't you have your mate who likes MotoGP come on with you? And basically you're going to see the inside of what happens when we're in a car together for a while. So Joel's been going to the races since 2009 in Indianapolis. That was your first race I took you to, right?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And so what hooked you?
You know, I'll tell you, I think the first thing that hooked me was the fact that, the racing's a fun sport, but just being there present. And then I think most notably was the smell of racing. It actually brought me into a different level, and just seeing it, hearing it, smelling it, it was just an incredible experience.
So it's one of those things that doesn't translate on a TV, does it?
Absolutely not.
So when you actually see it, it becomes something way more magical than what you ever thought it could be.
It's surreal, and it was just an incredible experience.
So you're hooked for life, right?
Definitely, no question about it.
So let's just get into it. Let's start. MotoGP, the year in review.
Yeah, Jim, one of the things I think you and I chatted about a couple times was the retirement of Danny Pedrosa. You know, he's only 33 years old. And, looking at what he's done in his career, what do you think his legacy is?
The bridesmaid, the Randy Mamola of the modern-day MotoGP. I mean, here's a guy who was supposed to be a world champion, who was a world champion in the smaller classes. And he had like a 125, a couple of 250 titles. I mean, this kid was the heir apparent to it. And he got on to the big bikes, and for whatever reason, he could never make it work. He tried. I mean, I think that's the thing that everyone's going to remember, is that here's a guy who tried and tried and tried, and then it just seemed like there was always heartbreak somewhere in there. It was always a crash with a broken collarbone, or a broken ankle, broken toe, broken foot, broken something. I mean, the guy's got to have as many broken bones as Evel Knievel, quite honestly. But that's his legacy. I think his legacy is the guy who came so close. He's the bridesmaid. He's the modern-day Randy Mamola.
Well, you know, Jim, I read an article a while back, and I was taking a look at it recently. I think it was dated back in July through Red Bull, and it was titled, Five Reasons Why Danny Pedrosa is One of a Kind. And I think I urge everyone to take a look at that article. It's, again, written by Red Bull back in July of 18. But there's really five key points that they talked about, which really resonated with me being a newer racing fan, if you will. One in particular was how loyal he was with Honda. You look back at Jorge moving from Yamaha to Ducati back to Honda. Obviously, Rossi moving from various manufacturers, but you got one guy in particular who stayed with Honda. Why do you think that was the case?
Well, it's a twofold answer for me. I think one of it is, I think Danny was just loyal to who was providing him the paycheck, right? I mean, arguably, I think Honda in the scope of MotoGP is equivalent to Ferrari in Formula One. Everyone wants to ride a Honda. I think everyone wants to race for Honda. I think everybody wants to ride for HRC. I think if you ask any of them in the paddock, I think everyone wants to, just like everyone wants to drive for Ferrari. I think people want to ride Ducati too, because I think there's that era of Italian, there's that era of mystique, there's that era of the uber alternate cool that is hip, that's trendy. But I still think most people want that seat. And you know, Danny was Spanish, right? So at the time when Danny kind of came to the fore, they didn't have we always had at least one Spanish rider on the HRC team, hence the Repsol sponsorship. And I think Honda kind of needed Danny to keep HRC happy, because he was able to bring Repsol along, because Repsol liked it because they have, you know, a Spanish rider on the team. And I think the other part of it is Alberto Puig. I mean, he was Danny's mentor, his manager. He was the guy that took care of everything, right? And so he kind of, as Alberto moved up, so did Danny. And, you know, Alberto is running the team now. So it's, that's the reason Danny's been there, because Danny's just been attached to Alberto at the hip. Now, the really interesting thing to me is, and you said it, is he's 33 years old. I think Danny had a few more years of racing left in him. And I think that's evident by the fact that he's got the KTM testing contract, right, for 2 years. So that takes Danny to 35. There's something happened, because I think I think it's amazing that Puge actually sort of kicked him overboard, right? Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden, you know, we're told, well, Danny's going to make some announcement. Oh, what's that going to be? Well, is Danny going to retire? Is he not going to retire? Is he going to sign for a couple more years? And then it was delayed. Well, was it delayed? Because in between, what did you got? You got all these whispers and everybody's reporting that, hey, Jorge Lorenzo has a contract with Honda. So there's a story. There's something back there that's going to come out later on that we're going to figure out how that happened. And, you know, I hope that I don't think Danny would hold a grudge against anything that happened. I just not so necessarily sure that he's leaving MotoGP on the terms that he wants to leave on. And there's a backstory somewhere in there. Somewhere.
Well, and you and I both have talked about this too over the years, is the talent is still there. Like I said earlier, being a kind of newer in the game, so to speak, I would have expected Danny to be writing at least at some capacity on some manufacturer besides just the test side of it. So from my perspective, a little disappointed not to see him on a bike this coming year. But I understand that, you know, I respect, obviously, his career, 18 years, almost 300 races, 3 world championships, none in MotoGP, unfortunately. But I think overall, Danny's going to be missed.
I think he will. I mean, he's going in as a legend, and rightly so. And, you know, you're actually living up to your accounting / financial guruism, because you got stats like there's no tomorrow. You know, you're like the new, we might have to have you full time just to be the new stat man from Harry Lloyd, okay?
Well, you know, Jim, you and I both know data, it's all about the data. It's all about the data.
Unfortunately, it is all about data, right?
Well, you know, the other thing too, Jim, I think we have a lot of conversations about just Yamaha in general, how strong they were 2 years ago. Rossi resigns, Vinales is there, strong, arguably a very strong team, but a lot of issues in 2018 with Yamaha. And so, and then we've got Rossi turning 40 in February. So where do you see the struggles of Yamaha changing in 2019 compared to 2018?
Oh, God, the Yamaha struggle. I mean, that's the story of the year, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, who would have thought that Yamaha would actually be struggling as hard as they are or have been this entire year? It's crazy to me that Yamaha couldn't get on top of the situation that they were in. And I think people have written about this at ad nauseum. I think we've sort of talked about it ad nauseum. But the big points were that they could not get the electronics to work. They could not get the engine to work. And they could not get the setup to work. Now, Yamaha was slow on the uptake to get a hold of somebody who actually knew the Magneti Marelli system, because that's the system that everybody has to run. They eventually have now got the guy who was with the Pata World Superbike team, and I think Andy and Dave were talking about the fact that he was actually at Ducati, kind of helped develop the original software. So he's actually made a whole lot of gains with the system, where, you know, if you look at Honda, you look at Ducati. I mean, of course, Ducati was immersed in the software. Honda found people who were Magneti Marelli specialists, put them in there. And so that was the first thing. It's like, okay, why didn't Yamaha see that? They should have. The second thing in there that's a mystery to me is the motor. And the fact that they basically don't have enough crank weight. And apparently they weren't watching Suzuki enough, because Suzuki had that same problem where they didn't have enough crank weight. So now you get a bike that spins too fast, slows down too fast, and then is just too abrupt. Well, it can't work with the rear tire. And that's the other mystery in all of this, is the entire Yamaha Michelin tire debacle thing. If you look through the grid, basically you have Rossi, Dovizioso, and Lorenzo, who have experience with Michelin tires. before they went to Bridgestones. Okay. So, you know, Freddie Spencer talked about this in his Motorsport Magazine vlogs and stuff about how the fact that the Michelin is a way grippier, way better rear tire than the Bridgestone. And the Bridgestone front is, according to Colin Edwards, uncrashable. So you have a front end that doesn't want to work or doesn't give you back any kind of feel with a rear end that gives you an insane amount of grip that works. And Freddie said, well, that was the way the Michelins were when I was riding 500s back in the 80s. Well, Rossi rode 500s. He rode on Michelins. Rossi should know that you've got to put more weight on the back of the chassis. Now, Rossi never said that they ever tried that, never said that they moved the settings around and all of this, right? But Vinales made a big to-do about it when he said, hey, I went to Thailand and I put a bunch of weight on the rear of the motorcycle and suddenly I can ride the motorcycle the way I want to. Well, wait a minute. Rossi should have known that, right?
Good point.
So I don't know. Maybe Rossi tried and it didn't work for Rossi, okay? But I can't help in the back of my mind sit there and go, where is Jeremy Burgess when you need him, right? Because you have Rossi's crew chief, Sylvain. I can't think of his name. You usually know, usually have it, but he was always a super bike guy, and he comes over and he's doing his thing with Rossi. And I can't help but think that Burgess would have looked at Rossi at some point and said, hey, look, we got to put more weight on the rear tire. But we didn't. Or he did, and they couldn't make it work. But I mean, Rossi's so adaptable. Nobody has reinvented himself more or reinvented his riding style more than Valentino Rossi over the time that he's been in there. He's been on two strokes. He's been on the 900. He was on the 990s with very limited traction control to full-on 800s with an insane amount of electronics to where we are now on 1,000 cc's with a limited stock electronic system. And there's a disconnect there in my mind of why Yamaha couldn't get to where they need to go. Now, from a testing standpoint so far, they've done nothing but work on the engine and try to figure out how they're going to get the crank weight correct to get it so they can get out of the corners with it. Vinales was testing it. He thought, hey, this is a great, that's the motor. It's awesome, you know, because everybody has to have their motors figured out by Jerez. At the end of the Jerez test, that's it. Because you got to have enough time to build enough parts, pieces, and equipment for the year. So everybody's going to run that spec of engine. And I just, you know, it's one of those things. It's a mystery. It's a mystery how Yamaha evaporated like that. But it's no one's fault. It's just, they're just late to the dance.
Well, you know, Jim, we talked about this numerous times too. The fact that, what is it? Is it the chassis? Is it is acceleration software? You move one part and it changes the whole equation to everything else. And I think all in all, I think you look back on it, and one of the questions I've seen pop up periodically is, should Yamaha ditch their faithful inline four in favor?
Not maybe gonna happen.
V4. Yeah, see, I agree with you.
Not gonna happen.
See, I agree with you too. The other question that
they might ditch the cross-plane crank.
Good point.
Now that they may change.
Yeah. Good point.
But they're not going to change the inline nature of that motorcycle. Not going to happen. And I'm telling you, with Suzuki having an inline four and it being as sweet as it is, Yamaha is not going to, no.
Well, it kind of brings back,
it's not their ethos, right? Honda's always raced V4s.
Well, and that's a good point. I think
it's just not going to happen.
And I use the word faithful for a reason. I've seen in a lot of articles, they use that word, but at the end of the day, it's been kind of, it's been their ethos. And I think you start looking at who the manufacturers are today, how they're competitive, how they're not as competitive. Of course, Ducati has come to the top of the table, so to speak. And of course, Honda's there. But if you're going to rank the manufacturers today, and knowing the issues that Yamaha has, and they really haven't fixed yet, although they have some improvements, but they still haven't fixed them yet, who would be your top three manufacturers today? Would you have Suzuki up there? I know KTM's new to the dance, and so, but I mean, is Yamaha, have they lost that edge?
Okay. If you want to break it down, I'll break it down two different ways because I can't separate it and give you a definitive who's the best.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about a best average overall motorcycle that anyone in the paddock can ride and go fast on, Ducati's the best bike. Okay. Second best bike then is Honda. Third best bike, I would give it to Suzuki. Because Rins and Iannone had some really fantastic rides on those motorcycles.
That's right.
Right. When they, it might be a little finicky still trying to find their setup with the Michelins on it, but they're closer than they ever have been. Mm-hmm. And since basically since like Hopkins was riding the bike back in the late part of the 90s, maybe first part of the first, the 00s, maybe the noughties. So that's how I look at it. Now, if you want to look at it from a technical resource kind of dominant game player motorcycle, Honda's still the most dominant brand, right? And they're not going to be less than dominant because this is what they do. They have a racing budget that's unreal. And as Dennis Noyes wrote one time, they think of, you know, all the other Japanese manufacturers think of Honda as the NASA of motorcycles because they've got, you know, an unlimited budget basically to do what they want. But you also got a kid who can ride that motorcycle phenomenally, right? With, you know, Marquez and what he does. So I still think the Honda is probably maybe the best bike in the paddock. It has a few small quirks in it, and namely the front end. Because Crutchlow, Marquez, any of the satellite guys can't use anything other than a hard front tire on that bike. So when the testing commenced at Valencia and through to Jerez as well, Marquez was working on front suspension different. They brought different types of Olean's equipment. There was, I'm sure they were running through a myriad of different spring, valve, rebound combinations that they were looking for. And they were wanting to be able to make that motorcycle work on at least a medium tire to give Marquez a little bit more feel. And if, that's a dangerous thing, is if you give Marquez any more feel, he might just ride off into the sunset and be gone from everybody. But that was their focus of testing at the beginning. And they were also working on their motors, and they had to come up with what they were going to use at the end. But you have to make that motorcycle friendly enough for everybody to ride it. Okay? And I think that they've done a pretty damn good job of it, because Marquez was quick on the bike. Maybe not outright fastest, but that's not what we're going for here. You had Crutchlow's not riding because he was injured in that vicious crash at Phillip Island. But you had Nakagami was at or near the top every time that they were out. And new boy Jorge Lorenzo was at or near the top too. I think he's like fourth fastest. So there's a guy that you know is all about corner speed, all about front end feel. And he's riding incredibly well on the bike on his first time go around, which should knock anybody's doubts that he could ride that Honda. But that's how I see it.
Well, and I think all together too, I think we've got some wonderful stories as we head into 2019. I think, you know, if anything, Yamaha is probably a little bit behind the curve compared to Honda and Ducati, even Suzuki, I would say. I would agree with you on that. The other kid, new kid at the block, though, KTM, how do you envision them in the next 2, 3, 5 years? Do you see them being a top two manufacturer? Do you think they have the capability to be a top two, top three manufacturer to compete at that level? Maybe where Honda's at today, Ducati, and maybe where Yamaha is trying to get back to being.
KTM has the money. They have the engineering resources. And they've never yet lost at what they've set out to do. If you need an example of that, look at American Supercross. KTM wanted to beat the Japanese at the game of Supercross in the United States. Roger DeCoster took over the team. He built it up. He put the right riders on the right bike, continuously developed, and Dungey ran off a couple of titles on a KTM.
Good point, yeah.
So you've got plenty of money from Red Bull. That isn't an issue. Mm-hmm. You have some good engineers who are going to be able to make that bike better, and they're very serious, because when Pedrosa didn't have a ride, who did they ink? They put his name on a contract for 2 years, and they're not going to try to worry about him wildcarding, because they want to focus solely on testing and making that bike better. And I think KTM will. KTM took their Moto 3 bikes and have given Honda an absolute run for their money in that class. And to be honest with you, when we got to Le Mans in Moto 3 and they put the new airbox and exhaust on that KTM, it would out-accelerate and had more top end than the Hondas had. To the point, at the end of this year, Honda and HRC have come back and said, well, we're building an all-new Moto 3 bike, and we're going to take it back, what's rightfully ours. So their engineering and their gameplay is completely solid. They will, as long as there isn't a corporate CEO problem somewhere that says, no, this isn't any value to what we're doing. But since, you know, their slogan is KTM ready to race. So they're in it, and they're in it to win it. And I would not be surprised that after Marquez's contract runs out with Honda, that he doesn't at least sniff or have some big money offer from KTM. Because it's almost a match made in heaven.
Yeah, good point. Well, and you know, as you look at today, the Red Bull logo, the money that supports that team, is second to none, I think, in a lot of respects. And no, good point, Jim. I think it's going to be an interesting 2019.
Zarco went to KTM on the factory ride.
Good point.
Yeah. And Zarco has made a lot of noise about how you don't have to ride it like Paul Espargaró and be vicious with it and fling it around and be absolutely crazy on it. His smooth, silky style will work. Well, if you think about it, that's kind of what you want that bike to be. You want it to be a bike that can work for either person. And if you've got Danny helping you with, this is how the engines feel, this is how the acceleration should be, this is how a no clutch gearbox, synchronous gearbox, or quick change gearbox, however you want to look at it, is supposed to feel. He'll tell you, hey, you know, your time lag between gear changes is too long. Well, we got to dial the electronics into another couple hundred milliseconds, and then they're going to be right there because we can't afford to lose that tenth. We got to smooth that transition of gear changes out because that's less harm on the tires, which means we can go farther and we don't have to manage the tire as well. So it's going to work. It's just, it's time. And they made a huge jump to the end of this year. You know, Paul got that podium in Valencia, admittedly attrition-based in the rain, but I really don't care about that. KTM was coming on. And I think that they have the ability. They're going to look at that, they're going to take that as a high point, and they got a taste of the champagne, and those boys want more. And I think they're off-season, they're going to work harder at it. They've got Zarco, who's got a... You know, Zarco, that first day in Valencia, he had that Rossi, Lorenzo, Ducati stare of 1,000 yards, and so maybe Zarco's was like only maybe 750, but he opened his eyes because he was not prepared for how that KTM had to be ridden. And if you can get Zarco's style melded into that, that bike will do some damage with Zarco on it.
Oh, it's exciting. Someone of my nature coming into the sport, following it. I think Yamaha Suzuki were the two that I looked at as kind of delved upon when I first started and following the MotoGP, and now with obviously Suzuki, KTM, and et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be an incredible 2019. But, you know, leading into 2019 itself, one of the questions I've got, and I keep pondering, yet one of the most aggressive...
I can see the smoke coming out of your ears. Every time you ponder, the smoke comes out. Keep going.
It's that whole notion that it's a competitive field. You've got the great riders from top to bottom. Manufacturers become more competitive from that perspective as well. No question about it. Yamaha is now sliding a bit, but you got KTM and everybody fighting for that top slot all the time. You know, is 2019 another year for Marc Marquez and everybody else in second place? And I hate to think that simply because I love to see the competitive nature of each race. Seeing Dovi come in and battling Mark every weekend, but and then having Zarco and Rins actually being to the front now. But you look at 2019 and where things sit today, Jim, and I think, where do you see 2019? Can anyone beat Mark for the championship?
It's possible, but the problem is that you have a guy who is basically at his zenith of his powers. Marquez is Valentino Rossi at 2002, 2003, 2004. If anybody was made to race on Michelin tires, it was Marquez, because he has to ride in the moment and ride everything by feel. He doesn't really care what the motorcycle does underneath of him because he's a dirt tracker. The track changes all the time. From the beginning of the day when you start riding to the end of the day, that track is going to go through a metamorphosis, nothing short of what a caterpillar does to become a butterfly. It's not going to be the same thing. You'll have wet slick, becoming dry slick. If you condition it somewhere in there and the moisture comes back, and as the day goes into night, if it's lit, guess what? The moisture will come back and the cushion will reappear again. Well, that whole feel thing is everything that Marquez understands. And we beat this down again, is the tires. That front tire on the Michelin is a lack of feel. So you have to respond to it intuitively. You have to feel where that is. And Marquez has that ability. He just has a feel. He just understands what that bike's going to do and what he needs to do to keep that bike on two wheels. All the crashes you saw Marquez do this year, which were significantly less than last year, in showing again a level of maturity from Marquez, are basically, and Matt actually said this, they're traction development or traction understanding moments where he's trying to figure out where is the traction at. Oh, okay, that was one step too far. Now I need to kind of pull it back a little bit. And that's where the limit is for today with that tire on this track. And that's what makes Marquez special, is that part of it. And I mean, I haven't seen anybody ride a motorcycle like Marquez rides that motorcycle since Freddie Spencer. And that's saying something, is because Marquez has basically took almost every one of Spencer's titles, and he's got a damn good shot at taking 10 titles and being better than Rossi. And he's also got a chance to win more races than Agostini, because it just depends on what nothing happens to him. I mean, we know he's had this shoulder problem. We know that his left shoulder has been popping out, and Dr. Mir, who operated on him and put the shoulder back into place, it was remarkable that he was actually able to win the world title with as bad as his shoulder was. So shoulders can be a death blow to a motorcycle racer. Ben Spies' shoulder injury took him out. I think Doohan's shoulder was a problem that prevented him from riding after the 99 season when he crashed at Jerez on the paint. So hopefully Marquez recovers from that and is able to keep going. But to me, Marquez showed this level of maturity this year that was well beyond his years. He learned that, hey, I don't have to win every race, although he tries. There are times when the mist comes down. I will give you Malaysia this year when he was chasing Rossi. I think he won Rossi just because it was Rossi. But
agree.
If it had been Dovizioso or something out front, Marquez may not have tried as hard, and he might have just rode it into second. But that's what I love to see about him. And I think that's what the mechanics love about him. And I think it doesn't matter what he does, you know, he's the man to beat, because you got a guy who has this team. He has Honda, and he has these people around him who are his core of great people. He has people that are inside that circle of trust, if you will, that is amazing. And this, the most astonishing thing, I think, this year was we found out, like, at Valencia from the MotoGP commentators, that Marquez, his crew chief, is Spanish. Mark is Spanish. They don't talk in Spanish at the racetrack. They talk in English.
That's interesting.
Which, that's amazing to me. That I would think that they would be all about their native language or whatever. But Mark had been groomed for all those years to speak English, because he wasn't really going to be able to speak Japanese, but a lot of the Japanese engineers speak English. So there was this not losing anything in translation going on. And the way Marquez is working inside of Honda right now reminds me of Michael Schumacher in Formula One and what he did at Ferrari. He is beloved by the engineers. He's the guy that they want to rally around him. You know, Marquez throws one in the gravel trap in qualifying. It doesn't matter. They roll the other bike out there, and they will do whatever they have to fix the other bike as fast as possible to be sure that Mark has two bikes, if it's like FP4 or something like that. They will work hard for him because he rewards them by putting that bike on pole or being on the front row or whatever it is that he's going to do. And that chemistry is hard to beat. So I don't think anybody can beat Marquez next year. I just, if anybody can, I would have to put money on Dovizioso and the Ducati, but it depends on what magic Gigi Delinea has with that bike. Can they just make it that just that little bit better where they don't work the tires as hard, and can Dovizioso get off to a better start and not lose the plot like he did this year? I mean, if Dovizioso didn't lose the plot, we could have had a hell of a season. But he did. So that's how I see it. I just don't think anybody can beat Marquez.
Well, and I think the other part, too, is you look at the addition of Llorente to the team. Obviously, the garage is in my opinion, is Mark's right now. Could there be some issues that pop up during 2019? My belief is, yes, there will be to some extent. I think Jorge is going to be competitive, and I think there's going to be times when it comes down to, do I overtake my partner in the final turn of the race for Mark, and or vice versa? And so it's going to be interesting to really look at just how Mark continues to progress as a rider, but also how the addition of Jorge is going to be. One thing you and I talk about all the time is the fact that you got huge talent coming out of Mark, just incredible. He'll take the bike to the ultimate apex, and then find out what the breaking point is, so that during the race he's not going to hopefully make that same mistake twice. But again, we're starting to see a maturation process of Mark too, where, like you said, which is incredible to see a guy as talented as Mark is, to say, look, you know what, second or third place in today's race is good enough. So it'll be interesting. I think it's going to be fun to watch. But I do think the king of the Honda garage today is no question, hands down, Mark. But could Jorge unseat him? Who knows?
Well, so you finally went to the white elephant that's in the room, the big elephant that's in the room, this Jorge Llorente in the Honda garage thing. Oh, I don't know where to begin with this one. I think this one is one of these, I hope that it is one, I hope it's Senna Prost-esque from the late 80s and Formula One, okay? Everybody's comparing it to that. Everyone's building it up. It's hype on hype on hype on hype on hype. But you know what? I don't think it's going to beat anything. I think it's going to be damp squib. And here's why. We had this kid named Maverick Vinales who moved to Yamaha, and it was going to be, here is the Marc Márquez, Maverick Vinales racing. This was going to be the ultimate. These two kids were going to go after each other tooth and nail, and it never happened. In that first year, we didn't see the two of them stand on the podium together at the same time until, what, the Asian flyaway races at the end of the year?
Late in the season, yeah.
It was incredibly late in the season. I just think the same thing is going to happen, because if there's one thing Márquez has beyond anybody else, his mind game is just far and away better than anybody's. And he does it not in the way Rossi does it. Rossi would be, you know, he would call you, he would, if you were his, he, if you were riding against him and he was beating you, think about this, like from the Sette Gibernau era, he would talk about, or Biaggi, he would talk about you as, oh, Max did this, or Sette rode very well, or it was always your first name. Well, as soon as you start beating Valentino Rossi, he comes back, now it's your surname. Well, Biaggi this, or Gibernau that. And Rossi's tried to get inside of Marquez's head. Tried really hard. Failed. Huge. Márquez just sits there and got a smile on his face. It's so big because he doesn't know any better, because he just loves racing a motorcycle. He has no care for politics. He has no care for whatever it is. I guarantee you, I bet he will show Jorge Llorente his data without any qualms whatsoever, have a smile on his face. And Jorge's going to look at that and go, how in the hell do you do that? And Mark's just going to have this big smile on his face, because I don't think Mark knows how he does half the shit that he does. I just don't see it, okay? So this whole big brouhaha in the Honda garage, yeah, it's going to be fascinating. It's what everybody's going to be talking about, but I think it's going to be a lot bigger deal, because push comes to shove, and it's the last corner. Red Mist Márquez is going to come out, and he will bump Llorente out of the way to take the victory without question. There will not be team orders in it, and if there was, he wouldn't listen to it anyway, because it's like the Matt Oxley article in Motorsports Magazine where he's talking about the race they had at Valentino's ranch. It's all about pride. it's simply pride driven, and no one is going to be able to get inside his head. Lorenzo thinks he's going to get inside of Marquez's head. He's not. And I think Valentino thought that too, but guess what? Marquez actually has a whole lot of space rented inside of Rossi's head because Rossi's just transfixed on trying to beat Marquez. Instead of, maybe that's why he couldn't get the bike to work for him, because he was so focused on trying to beat Marquez as opposed to trying to make his bike better. I don't know. Well, but there's an interesting dynamic there.
Well, and Jim, you used to race. I mean, it's, that's one aspect I've never been able to draw on in my life. You know, I grew up in the YouTube era of MotoGP sports, so when I want to see Spencer race, I see him on YouTube. I didn't see him up close and personal.
I never did either, but I mean, I always had to run to the mailbox and pull the cycle news out of the mailbox on Friday afternoons and read it cover to cover to figure out what happened. But yeah, I see. I see what you're saying.
Well, I think, you know, you used to race, so was there anybody that got into your head, and how did you deal with it? And
no, I never let anybody get inside my head. I mean, I think I did when I was dirt tracking. And I think a lot of people who grew up in the time that I did dirt tracking grew up with the Haydens dirt tracking too.
Yeah.
And then their reputation preceded them. And I think a lot of people just got, woo, hey, the Haydens are here. Well, I'm not winning today, kind of a thing. And I think I let myself kind of get there a little bit with that. But it was after that that you have to find out what's inside yourself. And you need to make those decisions on your own about what you're going to do. And I didn't really play mind games with anybody. I don't think that's what I would do. But there's always the little subtle things that you could do. Like, when I started road racing, I went to a road race school. So we'd go show up at the dirt track the next week. I'd wear my t-shirt from the road racing school. I'd be like, oh, did you go road racing? Yeah. Yeah, sure did. Oh, what's it like? Well, I'll tell you one thing. It makes dirt track look slow, painfully. Oh, and then their expressions would just be like, oh, right? And then, you know, it'd go road racing, and all of a sudden it'd be raining. And I'd show up on the grid with, you know, wets on or whatever, and there's guys just got this half down face, like, oh, it's raining, man. It's raining. I'd look at them. I just have this smile across my face, like, this is the greatest thing ever. Because I think more of it is what you convey in your own self-confidence. There's a fine line between being, having an ego and the confidence to win and be a great racer, and going over that line and just being cocky. And it just depends on which way it's going. You just got to be tough. And if you can do it and enjoy yourself while you're doing it, like Marquez does, I think that makes it a whole lot easier to actually be good and not be affected by everybody else. Because what do? You just sit back and relax, because you know.
Well, and you know, looking at it, one thing that always intrigues me in particular is, you know, you look at Dovey, for example. In my opinion, Dovey and Mark had a pretty good relationship this year. There's times, of course, they all butted heads, but you know, if this was Rossi and Marquez, we all know what happened there. So it's interesting from a non-racing perspective's mind to see how, when you go into the race or you're preparing for the season, you're preparing for your career, if you will, it's a long journey. And there's a lot more that goes into it, as I found out in the last 8 years, more than just jumping on a bike and racing.
There's more to that in any job. Okay, this is a job for these guys, right? They're paid to be at that level. You do the same thing in your job, whether you want to know it or not. You do. I've been fortunate enough to sit in meetings with you because you take care of things for me, and I appreciate that. But you walk in with a swagger, you walk in with a confidence, you walk in with that power suit, and you sit down and you got that same smile on your face that Marquez has. Because you know your stuff. That's all it is. It's confidence because you know what you can do. That's all it is. And the best way to have confidence is just to do that over and over and over and over again. Marquez goes out and trains every day. And I think Marquez spends some time in the gym, but I think most of the time that he spends training is riding dirt track. I mean, sure, he probably maybe hits the gym in the morning or something, and then for a couple hours, and then goes and rides the rest of the day. I think a lot of other guys are gymaholics. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with being in the gym. That's a great way to train, to put, you know, you need that winter to put back on the muscle and the mass that you lost from racing all those weekends. But there's something, and Ben Brostrom will tell you this, there's a thing called being race fit, and there's a thing about being gym fit. And they're two different things. And Bostrom would always talk about how he went through, after he came back from World Superbike, and him and his brother got into rock climbing really seriously in Vegas. And, you know, Ben couldn't ride. He came back to the U.S. and he couldn't win anything at all. And he said, well, I was too muscle bound on the bike because I became too strong.
Yeah.
So whatever Marquez is doing works for him. And maybe Lorenzo being in the gym for 6 hours a day works for him. Everybody's body is different. But again, it's just that confidence. That's all it is.
It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. You know, moving from Honda's garage, MotoGP, you know, again, looking at it from my perspective, and I brought this up probably a couple of times in the last couple of weeks, and so, but it's something that's really intrigues me. It's fascinating. Is we've got now the, of course, MotoGP, MotoGP 2, Moto 3. Now this new series called the FIMNL Moto E World Cup in 2019. Electric motors. And what's interesting about that is, you know, growing up as a child, it was all about the noise, the sound, the smell. You know, my dad had a 750 Suzuki. And so it was something to that nature. It was a gasoline kind of a motorcycle to that point. But
people were called petrol heads for a reason.
and we were. And I think when my first day back to the track in Indy years back in 09, I think that was what brought me back some of those memories. But you look at it from the future of motorcycles, the future of MotoGP, electric motors, I don't believe are going to take over the world today, tomorrow, next week. But when you look at it from Nicolas Gubert's, the Moto E's executive director's perspective, this is an interesting development. And I think, you know, you look at having three races, now going to be four races on certain weekends during 2019. I think there's five races for this, but it'll be before the Moto 3 race in the morning on Sundays will be this new category of electric motors. But you look at it, where do you see this heading? It's an incredible journey where we're at today, where the bikes have developed the electronics, but now we're going to this next level. Or is it a next level?
Yeah, this is a touchy subject for me. The engineer in me goes and looks at it and says, this is cool because it's something different. And it's very much outside of the norm. And I love that. I love new technologies. I like emerging technologies. That's unfortunate in my job and where I work that's what we do. We do a lot of looking at what are the new latest technologies, and we like to stay right at the bleeding edge of it. I think we're at that point right now. We're on the bleeding edge of getting this. Now, is this type of motorcycle going to ever replace the big gold wings and the people that got to go great distances? No, I don't think so, because their range is limited. I mean, when did they start doing the zero TT bikes at Isle of Man? I mean, I know it's got to be 5 years or more that they've been racing that. Mm-hmm. And they just now have gotten to where they've broken the record. They've broken the 100-mile-an-hour barrier for a 37¾-mile lap on a motorcycle, all powered by a battery.
Incredible.
That is incredible. And it's fast-developing technology to get there. But they only went 37¾ miles. That's all the farther they went. I can see it being an absolutely great way for people to get around in an urban area, to get around in the inner cities. I mean, you could have your electric bike. You could go to and fro very easily. It's not a traffic congestor. It's easy to get around in the small towns in Europe and in the larger cities here in the U.S. It's not going to be the bike that you're going to take out and go ride around the countryside for a while and for a couple of hours. Mainly just because of the charging technology. That's the biggest hurdle that we're trying to get over, is how fast do we charge it. And I think they're only going to do like three laps for the e-race, it's not long.
No, it's not.
Maybe five at the most, depending on length of track, I think, is what it comes down to. So they don't have their battery technology worked out either. But we have to go racing to figure out how to get those batteries better. A lot of people are down on the FIA Formula E car series. They're racing in the cities, and the very first time when they started that class, you had to have two chassis because you would have a pit stop where you actually changed chassis. The driver got out of his car, went and got into the other car. And now we're 4 years into that series, and now the cars will go the entire race on the charge that they have with regenerative braking and all those other techniques. Now, the regenerative braking is cool because you take the energy that you would normally use and lose in heat and friction, or in heat caused by friction and braking wheels on a car, you take that energy, convert it into electrical energy, and you put it into the battery. You recharge the battery from it. That's super cool. But I don't know how you make that regenerative technology work in a motorcycle, because it's that feel issue again. Now, if you could make the battery smaller, make it lighter, make it faster, and be able to regenerate electricity back off of it and get the range up, that's cool. But this is what you're going to have to do. Somebody's going to think about that and figure out how to make it more adaptable to the rider. You know, there's got to be some way to like dial it in or dial it out for how much, you know, because really there isn't any resistance braking. Like when you let off your gas on your bike today, it slows down because that's the internal engine, combustion engine is doing that. It's natural drag. You don't really have that in an electric motor. So it's going to kind of freewheel into the corner. So you got to figure out some way to kind of give that feel back to these guys. And I think that's where it's going to grow. It's going to get better. Is it going to fix it and be everything to everyone? No. But I do think it's going to appeal to the generations that are behind us, right? I think maybe us and maybe our kids will kind of think about motors and the sound and the smell and all that. But a lot of the millennials and the people behind them don't. A lot of millennials don't even want a car. So I think that all will appeal. It's something that you have to do, right? And there's no reason not to do it and try to do it, because it's where it's going. And you know, cars, bikes, petrol engines, they're not dead. But you kind of got to believe they're on their last leg.
Well, you know, too, the other thing that's quite fascinating when you look at it, I think, you got a bike that right now, maximum speed's, what, close to 260 kilometers an hour. You got a bike
that's... What's that in English?
Gosh, what is that, about 160 miles an hour?
Something close to that.
Something like that. And then so you look at it from that perspective, you got a bike that's kicking out 145 horsepower, close to a Moto 2 bike. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting. One thing.
The problem is the weight.
The weight.
Because it does not. It might have the same horsepower as a Moto 2 bike, but it does not weigh the same as a Moto 2 bike. And weight is the enemy. And more specifically, where you carry that weight in a motorcycle is very important. Like everybody thought, well, a lower center of gravity, well, that's where you should be, right? Like a car. Well, Honda tried that in 1984. They put the gas tank of their NSR 500 under the engine, and they had the exhaust pipes running over the top. Spencer tried to ride the thing, couldn't ride it. It sucked, because what they figured out was the center of gravity is not where the centerline axles of the wheels are. It's actually some point midway between the gas tank and the wheels. That's where its point is, because you got that gyroscopic effect that's causing it not to be there. And that's where this goes crazy. So you've got all these batteries, and so, you know, and if you think about it, Honda learned the most they of anybody could have learned about that experiment, right? Because that was like 86 when they made that bike that way, right? And basically by the time they got to about late part of the 90s, I'm going to say like 88, 89, they built this first CBR 900RR, which developed the concept of mass centralization, where they realized, oh, wait a minute, we got to put all the mass on that imaginary center line. And that 900 rocked. It was definitely a badass bike. But that's what they learned by going racing. The same thing's going to happen with the electric bikes. Just it's going to take some time.
Well, you know, the other part too, is, again, going back to my frame of reference, which is the petrol bike, so to speak. It's how do you make it appealing for race fans. And maybe, Jim, you're right. I think there's this next generation that maybe it's a little more appealing because their frame of reference is different than us to some extent.
It's perspective.
It is
perspective. It's how you see it, right? Yeah. I mean, look at it this way. World Rally was a really niche sport. Nobody followed World Rally cars. It's super cool, but nobody really followed it until somebody named Colin McRae came out with a Sega game, or was it PlayStation game?
PlayStation.
Colin McRae's World Rally.
Boom.
And suddenly everybody wanted to drive World Rally cars.
Yeah.
Because you could visualize what was going on, what was happening. Same thing's going to happen to electric bikes. It's just, I don't know what marketing, I don't know what tact, I don't know what people are going to have to do or what it is that draws people to it. Now, if it goes by me and it sounds like a phaser gun out of Star Wars, I'm hooked, I'm in. But if it goes by and it sounds like a Prius going by, no.
Well, and I would second that. And I think, Jim, good to get your insights on all this. I think the MotoGP realm is going to be exciting in 2019. Let's shift gears a little bit to Moto 2 and maybe even Moto 3 to some extent. What are you seeing going on at 2 right now?
Moto 2 was an interesting year from the standpoint of the anticlimacticness of the championship. I thought for sure Oliver on the KTM was going to not necessarily walk away with that title, but that he would actually do way better than he did this year. I mean, I think he won 2 races. It was ridiculous. And, Bagnaia was gold. And there's this difference between them. And that shocked me. I just don't understand where KTM lost the plot or where Oliveira lost the plot. I do not understand that one. But it was, well, what did we talk about? We talked about how bad he qualified every time. It's like, Bagnaia's on the front row. Baldessari would be on pole or something to that effect. And it was like, where's Oliveira? He's down in 12th. He's down in 13th. He's in 14th. He's in 15th. He couldn't qualify.
Great point.
It was, that was a season. The season struggle was to him trying to qualify. If he was near the front, what happened? He wound up winning. Now, I mean, KTM last year, they run off a string of wins from Aragon out, they ran off a string of wins between him and his teammate, and they looked so good, and it's just like, they're like Yamaha of the class, they lost the plot. I don't know if it was the different Dunlop tires, or they changed something in the chassis fundamentally, or exactly where it was, but it just wasn't what I expected, because I thought that title was, again, another title that would go down to the wire. Just like, you thought the MotoGP title was going to be decided between Dovizioso and Marquez, and it wasn't. Marquez had that thing showed up by the time we got out of Japan. Like, wow, that's like 4 races to go. And then you had Bagnaia, who was pretty close to wrapping it all up and had finished it off by the time we hit Sepang. And all credit to Bagnaia. He rode amazing all year long. Mm-hmm. And, it could be that steady influence of Rossi. Rossi's going to make a hell of a team manager. No way, shape, or form. Whenever Rossi decides that that's enough time in the leathers, and he's going to actually dedicate himself to managing and running the team, he is going to be a hellacious rider coach. He is going to be amazing at it. And he's going to build sort of the dynasty that Kenny Roberts wanted to build in MotoGP, but couldn't succeed with, because it's not Roberts' style. But Rossi's got that innate ability to look at the younger kids, identify with them, and maybe that's because he rides dirt track with them at his ranch all the time. Don't really know. But he's got it to where he can teach them what they're doing and say, who said it? It was either the guys on the MotoGP podcast, or I read it from Matt Oxley or something. But they all the VR46 riders all go to Rossi's motorhome at the end of the day. And they all sit down and they analyze things together and they talk through it all. That's invaluable. Because you got a guy who's been there, done that, and has basically blazed a trail that pretty much lets them see what it's like to do, to be. And this is what it takes to be at that level. And if you've got that on your side, that's even better.
Well, if you look at the ranks of Moto2 too, I think as we look at it going into 2018, even 2019, from my perspective too, I think one of the disappointments that I saw going into actually ending 2018 season was the fact that Marquez wasn't there yet.
Alex.
Okay. And so I look at that as a, is this all we're going to get? Where was Bagnaev a couple of years ago? Where was he in relation to Marquez? And now we see, are people starting maybe to hop over Alex for a position? I don't know. I just...
Mir did.
Good point.
You see, that was the other interesting thing in the season. Mir did not live up to expectations. Like, okay, that kid came out of Moto3, was the bomb. Basically, nobody could beat it. His racecraft, everything was just insanely good. And he goes in there like, well, hey, you know, this kid may not win the title, but he's going to be on the podium. He's going to be right there. He'll just do the normal rookie kind of thing. He'll run off the track a couple of times. He might fall off here and there, but he's going to basically look good. And he's going to be really good, and he's going to take a season of learning, and basically he's going to just maybe miss out on the championship finish in the top three. He'll come back for one more year in Moto2, and he'll dominate like he did in Moto3. Uh-uh. He's moving directly to Suzuki. And I had postulated that he would gel on that Suzuki because it was the most Moto3-like Moto. It was the most Moto3-like MotoGP bike in terms of handling that is on the grid. And he did not disappoint on the Suzuki. You know, I get it. He probably didn't want to be in the class because you got the big change. You're going to Triumphs. Three cylinders, 775 cc's, I think. So it's going to be different. The motors are going to be different. They're going to feel super different. There's a lot of things about that class that are going to change for next year. And it's going to be, they're adding electronics to it now. So you got to have some ability to set up the electronics or be able to work with your electrical technician or your electrics guy. And that's a good thing for the class. That makes that class that more, much more interesting. It puts a little bit more into it. And, you know, it makes it to where everybody's going to be riding that class differently. And I'm hoping with the more torque that it's going to kind of help Joel Roberts, the lone American, to look a little better in that class. I think the Triumph and the more torque is a little more dirt tracky type motor, a little bit more ride it sideways, square it off, use the torque kind of a thing, and not so much a huge back it in, square it off, keep the motor spinning kind of a bike. I think it's a more dirt tracky style, you know, sort of back it in, use the torque, roll off the corner, keep it driving, and maybe he'll do better. And he's also going to be in a better team. You know, so in those things, I'm looking forward to Remy Gardner. He's on a much better team for next year. So all that is going to make the Moto2 class really interesting for me for next year. It just, there's change, and it's going to throw up a surprise. We're not, you know, is it, you know, Jorge Martin wound up, I think he hurt himself in testing on the new bike. So who knows? Is Martin going to be the man to beat in that class too? We don't know. But that's the fun of Moto2, is you kind of, there are guys who can ride the little bikes, ride them really, really well, and you put them on a bigger bike and they can't do it. And you got guys that, you know, other way around, you know, they can't do anything on a little bike, but you put them on a big bike and suddenly, whoa, it fits, it works. So that's pretty amazing.
So who's the guy to beat then, you think? As we speak today.
To be honest with you, I think, because so many guys have moved up and moved, I think Moto2 is a wide-open affair, to be honest with you. I think we'll know more when we get done with the testing at Sepang in February. I think we might have a little clearer picture of who's where. But right now, it's all over the place. People are trying to learn new bikes, new chassis. But it will come down to whoever has the best crew. So you kind of got to think that the guys at Tech 3, Guy Coulomb and company, mm-hmm. they've got enough experience that they're probably going to be at the front with the KTM chassis. You have, of course, the IO team. They've got a lot of time with that chassis and set up. So they're going to kind of be there. And I think the VR46 guys are going to be there. Because, again, you've got that experience. You have good crews that are going to help you sort that bike out and make it better. So I think Moto2 is just completely wide open.
Well, and you look at all the ages today. These guys are only in the early 20s, most of them, early 20s. Alex Marquez, 22. You've got Bagnaia, 21. I mean, these guys, it's going to be a fun season. And I think as we kind of shift gears a little further, deeper down that realm of the MotoGP realm, if you will, Moto3, 2019.
Let's think about 2018 first. I thought that the best racing was in Moto3 this year.
I did too.
There were some races that were just phenomenal. What surprised me was the fact that Jorge Martin did not run away with the title. We were wondering who was going to be the guy who was going to step up, who was going to take the fight to Jorge Martin, because we agreed that Jorge Martin was the man to beat going into it. We did not know that Bezzecchi was going to just not necessarily come from nowhere, but Bezzecchi was riding completely out of his mind, and he rode fantastic. He was helped a little bit, I think, by the KTM. It was definitely the better bike than the Honda. But Jorge Martin showed you how much skill he has on the brakes and going late. He also showed you at different times a lot of maturity as to when he would go out and qualify and how he would get his toes, where he would get his toes, his timing about when he was going to go out. But that's also a little bit of the Del Conca Grassini team. They're the ones who are very good at that as well. Because, look, Gigi Antonio, Martin's teammate, finished second in the World Championship. Bezzecchi was third. So the other thing that was really interesting to me in the Moto3 class was the fact that these guys kept trading crashes.
Good point.
You know, it was the beginning of the year, and you know, it was like, well, Jorge Martin couldn't stay on a motorcycle. And then for a few races, you had Bezzecchi couldn't stay on a motorcycle. And you had, the injury to Martin at Brno, where he broke his left wrist or left forearm. And you thought, well, okay, this is Bezzecchi's. And well, then Bezzecchi would just the unforced error. And then when he really needed it, he got caught up in somebody else's crash in Australia, which kind of set up the race to be, the championship to be won. If he could do it, if Martin and everything fell the right way there. And boom, it was done by the time we left Sepang. We go to Valencia looking for a really great dogfight in Moto3 and didn't get it. So I was disappointed in that. I was happy to see Martin win the title. I felt really happy for him. I thought he deserved it. I thought it was such a trying year where I think he really learned that you don't give up and you always do the best that you can do. He was helped because of the Silverstone rain debacle and other things. But all in all, though, we're talking about guys that can't stay on their bike, namely Martin and Bezzecchi. How about Jakob Kornfeld, who kind of can evil a bike? I mean, that's save of the year right there. I'm telling you, Le Mans, when Bastianini spins the bike off in the last turn, and Kornfeld hits it, wheels up, boom, does his best deal Knievel. And the best part, he hits the gravel, calmly just keeps it pinned, looks over his shoulder, yeah, it's okay, it's easy to get, I got space to get back on the track, and sure enough, he just goes right on there. So, I mean, that got played. You saw that on ESPN Sports Center here in the States. I mean, everybody was talking about that. So, I mean, that was definitely one of the more intuitive and wild and crazy things that happened during that season. But let me throw this question at you. Let's break it down. In MotoGP, who was your rider of the year? Who impressed you more than anybody else?
That's a great question. I think in the beginning of the year, I thought Lorenzo probably. I think the way he's riding the bike, but towards the end of the season, I thought Renz was so strong and competitive that I would give him the nod to some extent as well. It's looking at it from a perspective of the results they got, the fight in the bike during the whole race or during the race, being able to come back. I felt like Lorenzo was there most of the time when he at least was on the bike. Or if the weather was at least half decent. Of course, I think when it starts to rain, it seems like his his pace seems to struggle. But I was really, really impressed with Rins. And I think that's where I think I'm intrigued going into 2019 is Suzuki, Rins. Could he be a potential challenger if the stars lined up? Again, it's going to be a big if. But I think 2019, I can see Rins being there.
So Rins is your rider of the year.
I would call Rins the rider of the year.
Rider of the year.
And it's tough.
It's very tough.
That's a tough one.
I have to choose between three. I have to choose between Marquez, I have to choose between Rins, and I have to choose between Jorge Lorenzo. Lorenzo gets an honorable mention to this one because he did something that really not even Rossi could do, and that is win on a Ducati. And not only went on a Ducati, he won several races on a Ducati. Bad luck kind of stalled his championship charge, and the lack of Ducati listening to him as far as seating position and those kind of things really kind of messed Lorenzo up. But Lorenzo, you know, here's the grain of salt that goes with that and why I take that away from him. I take it away from him because he was riding on a motorcycle that was far and away much, much better than the one Rossi got on. And that is not a slight on Lorenzo and what he accomplished. It just, that doesn't make him rider of the year for me. Okay. Rins, incredible. I mean, if you watch the Assen race, which was probably
impressive,
probably race of the year, possibly. If you watch Rins in that race, he was amazing. And his knock and why I take him off of rider of the year for me, consistency. He couldn't do it every week. There was weeks that he was struggling, didn't have it figured out. There was weeks where he'd show up and he was the fastest thing on the planet. He got screwed at Valencia with the red flag. Rins was gone in that rain race, people. I hate to tell you that he was gone. That was Rins' race, and he got shafted. That red flag ruined him. I get it. It was a safety issue, and I am not going to bash race direction for that one because I'd have done the same thing. Because Rins was slowing down by the tune of like 3 to 4 seconds a lap because it was that bad. So, but again, it's that consistency. You have to bring your A game to the racetrack every week. You have to do that. And Rins is close. He's just not quite there yet. So I have to give it to Marc Marquez. I know that's cliche. And it's not because he won the world title. It's not because did he win 10 races or something like that.
Incredible.
But it's Marc Marquez because I saw a mature, thoughtful, thinking Marc Marquez as opposed to the raw talent, rough riding Marc Marquez. And that change to me was significant. This is a guy, I said it earlier, who now thinks about what he's doing and is thinking about how he rides and how he races. And his mental game is so strong. And to be able to understand that this is maybe as good as I can do today. And I'm just going to come back and fight for this again next week. And not throw this thing in the weeds. Because really, Marquez, in the races, the only race he made an unforced error was Mugello. And because he had to run the hard front and he had no feel, was pushing it way too hard in the beginning of the race and tossed it away. And after that, he never tossed it away again in a race at all. Did he have his moments? Yes. But he kept it under control. And that's how you're a champion. So that's right. That's right. So how about race of the year? I think I gave it away for what I was thinking, but gosh. Race of the year MotoGP. Do you have one? You can say COTA because we were there.
You know what? I'm gonna say COTA.
You would.
You know, it's this, even though, as we know, Mark ran away with that one too. So, it's a tough one. That's a tough question. What about you, Jim?
It's got to be Assen. Assen was the most incredible race. It was that race where literally I pretty much ripped holes in the leather couch because I was afraid that we were going to see like 7 or 8 guys just go wadding up into some gravel trap. And they, you know, at the end of that race, if you didn't sit there and go, you weren't alive, because that race was so amazing. And anytime there was a stoppage, I mean, even when you had the Silverstone water debacle, they showed the Aston race again. They showed the Aston race all next week for free on the MotoGP video pass because that race was that amazing. So that's race of the year, no question.
Well, maybe even it's a good choice. Good choice. I think the other one that comes to mind is Bernal. Yeah, in a Czech Republic. I think looking back on that, from my perspective, it seemed to me that your hair was on your arms setting up the whole race. It was battling. It was just one of those incredible, fascinating races to watch.
Okay. So for the final thing for MotoGP, what was the one thing that was like was the ultimate high, and what was the ultimate disappointment?
I would say to start with, I think the ultimate high being a newer race fan. I like the competitive nature of the whole racing field. I think it's not just one guy. Yes, Mark is the clear favorite, no question about it. But you got some of the young guys coming up, not just through MotoGP, but Moto2, Moto3 as well. So I think the competitive nature there, and I think that the hunger for manufacturers and the racers and the riders, if you will, to stay, no matter how old you're getting, to stay aggressively active and trying to put the best product on the field is impressive. The flip side, I think one of the biggest disappointments is Yamaha. I think
you can't let that go, can you? That's because you're a Rossi fan. Yeah. That's your problem right there.
Well, and as you know, I had to pick a racer when I first.
I told you not to pick Rossi.
And you did. You told me not to.
Didn't listen to me.
And you did tell me that Mark was going to be the next the next great racer. Jim, you need to manage my money.
No, you do mine, okay?
But I'll tell you, looking back on it, just the pure disappointment that Yamaha, each week, I just felt like they couldn't compete. And it was just, what's next?
I agree with you on the most impressive thing, the closeness of all the factories. Though every motorcycle can almost win on every day. I think if you're on a Honda, a Ducati, a Suzuki, or a Yamaha, you have an incredible chance at standing on the podium.
Yep.
KTM and Aprilia are not, KTM is not that far away. They got their first podium at Valencia. But Aprilia is trying, but they're not quite there. But the racing is closer among factories than what we've ever seen. So that's, you know, and kudos to the rules makers, kudos to the teams and all that. The biggest disappointment of the year for me has to be the rain out at Silverstone.
Yeah.
I felt so bad for the British fans. You stood there in the rain all weekend, over and over again, and you had that terrible crash where they aquaplaned at the end of the hangar straight, and the right call was made as far as a safety issue, but it was disappointing that we actually got to that. And there's that whole debacle and the whole story of what all happened in there and whatnot, but that left a disappointing taste in my mouth. So let's look at Moto2. Rider of the year for you, Moto2.
I would have to go with it's tight, it's close. Bagnaia. Could it be Bagnaia? I would say that's tough. Jim, I'll tell you that's a toughie. I'd probably stick with Bagnaia. I think the raw talent is there. I think ultimately Bagnaia.
I think Bagnaia too. I mean, he did everything right. Did what you got to do. I will say, I think the biggest disappointment, there's a tie for biggest disappointment. One, Alex Marquez not being consistent enough to challenge for a championship.
Yeah.
And Mir only having one podium, I think. Maybe two podiums in the class. I thought for sure he would have done better than that. So those are two disappointing things. Plus, Oliveira's disappointing qualifying. It just didn't really work. Didn't really work there for me. So, how about we get to the Moto3, and we look at who we think goes the rider of the year there?
Oh, hands down, Jorge Martin, no question.
I'll give it to Bezzecchi. Because I think no one, I think everyone expected that out of Martin. Yeah. You know, here's a kid that just came in there. I mean, if you really want to look, you know, Moto 3 is set because you could make an argument for Ohno at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. That kid, 15 years old, and he looked great. And it would have been one thing if he would have showed up at Valencia. It was a dry race and he ran out the front. That would have been one thing. But when you're in those kind of conditions and you can ride to that level and make everybody else look
incredible.
Now, granted, there wasn't a championship on the line between Bezzecchi or Martin, so they really didn't have to do anything crazy, but nobody could really handle the kid. And he had all of his moments on tree. It's one thing if you're on if you're in a tricky track, conditions like that, he proved he can ride. So going forward, I look for him to make some kind of splash. Don't really, I mean, he's already won a race, so not too sure what's going to go on there, but it's definitely going to really be interesting for sure.
Well, and you look at the field on that last year. I mean, Giantonio, Bezzecchi, Bastianini, De La Porta, I mean, Eric Canet, just a talented group. And again, it gives the notion kind of what we talked about a few minutes ago. What's exciting about the sport? And coming from my perspective, it's not one guy per se that's really leading the effort. It's the full, it's all the manufacturers, it's all the riders. Just an extremely competitive field, more competitive today than it was 8 years ago when I first started following the sport.
Yeah, it is. And that's a testament to Dorna, to what they're doing. But let me ask you this question quick. Can you, you don't really have maybe the perspective, so maybe it's better if you were to ask me this question, but of all the tracks, do you think, if you could, and money's no option, so whoever owns the track is a multi-billionaire and can put all the money they want into it to make it up to spec, but are there any tracks that are missing in your mind? Now, I know you don't have like years of seeing question. All the tracks, but just a curiosity.
Well, in what regard? In terms of...
Well, okay, if you flip it around and you ask it to me, there's two tracks in my mind that jump out right now that should be on the calendar and are not. One, the Istanbul track in Turkey. That sucker's amazing. Okay? And with Onçu coming on, hopefully we can go back to Turkey. Because that, I mean, I admit, the last three, four, five corners of that track are mamby-pamby, Formula One, just look at the cars because they're going so slow-type corners. But that first part of that track is amazing. I mean, it goes uphill, it goes downhill, and it's got a fast kink uphill straightaway. That just was awesome. So to me, that track needs to be back on the schedule because I would sacrifice I would sacrifice Barcelona for that race. I would put it in place of it. I don't really like the Barcelona track. I don't think it really works for MotoGP. So I would put Istanbul in there for that one. The other one that kind of jumps out at me that really isn't there that should be, Portimao.
Oh, good point. Because
that track, it's still on the Iberian Peninsula, right? And it's, you know, there. But you could take away or just add it to the list and it would be fine for me. But those are the two that stand out for me. So, well, I think that's about it. I think we covered everything that we could think of covering, right?
And I think so.
Hopefully it was a great year. Hopefully 2019 is a better year. I appreciate you doing this with me. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it. This is what happens in the truck when we drive back and forth to Columbus all the time. So this is the banter that we have between good friends. And that's what the show's always been about, is the banter between good friends. And if you liked it, great. If you didn't like it, well, please let us know. Either way, send all your feedback to motopod@motopodcast.com. It would be greatly appreciated. We want to learn from what you guys like, what you don't like. And we want to just make the show better and make it. And the only way we can do that is if we hear from all of you guys. And if you really like the show, if you could help us out in any way possible, you could donate. Go to motopodcast.com. Look on the webpage. There's a PayPal and a Patreon link for you to donate to the show. For all of you who do donate, thank you so very, very much for those donations. They really help. They're able to help us get the credentials and get the interviews and get to races and other things of that nature. So every little bit that you guys can give us is greatly appreciated. And with that, that's it for the MotoGP Roundup. I want to wish everybody out there in Motopod land a very happy Christmas and a happy holiday season. And hopefully we will be back after the new year with our testing from Sepang and all the other stuff that goes with it. Because the show might be going to a bit of hibernation. There is no racing, and we basically start delving into hockey and whatnot. And that's really not what this show's all about. So, for us, that's it. Thanks for listening.